Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Thursday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on July 3rd of 2011, under the headline, The Wreck of the Glen Eslyn, Insurance Fraud? Or just drunken incompetence. Here we go. One beautiful, clear October day, 98 years ago, astonished onlookers watched a big, square-rigged sailing ship simply turn and sail straight into the side of Neocony Mountain. If such a thing had ever happened before, nobody could remember it. Why would a full-size windjammer and crew simply sail into a mountain as if it didn't exist? If the ship were in some kind of trouble, wouldn't its crew drop the sails at the very least? And there were some very nice beaches suitable for emergency groundings that would do minimal damage to the south at Manzanita and to the north at Cannon Beach. Why not try for one of these? Nobody knows for sure. For whatever reason, the captain and crew of the ship refused to talk much about it. But there are several pretty good possibilities. First, a bit about the ship. She was the 1,818-ton steel-hulled square rigger Glen Eslyn, 260 feet long, built in 1885 in Glasgow. For two decades, this big, astonishingly fast windjammer was the pride of the C.E. DeWolf & Company fleet. But soon after the turn of the new century, things started to go sour. Not just for the Glen Eslyn, but for all sail-powered capital ships. Steam power hadn't been much of a threat at first. But by the early 1900s, engine and drive systems had gotten efficient enough that there was simply no longer any reason for an owner to run a sail-powered ship. They were slower, less predictable, and far less flexible, being really only efficient when running downwind or reaching across it. No reason that is except for one. The owner can't afford to replace the ship. In 1913, there were a number of obsolete windjammers plying the seas for that very reason. The Glen Eslyn was one of them, and she hadn't turned a profit in years. Luckily, after the October 3rd accident, the owner would have a nice fat insurance check with which to replace the old money-losing blowboat with a shiny new steamship. Yep, naturally insurance fraud was the first thing most people thought of when trying to understand what had happened. Indeed, if that were the plan, it could hardly have been better executed. The Glen Eslyn fetched up on rocks, tearing a hole in her steel hull and making a refloat impossible. The almost full suit of sails, still full of air hours after the accident, guaranteed that the ship would stay on the rocks long enough to break up. The shore was close enough to hit easily with a rescue line, virtually guaranteeing that nobody would be killed. Indeed, most crew members probably didn't even get their pants wet. Once safely on shore, Captain Owen Williams and his officers refused to tell anyone what had happened, which of course made people all the more suspicious. But there were some other possibilities, too, and some reasons to believe fraud wasn't the goal. First, there was good old demon rum. The captain was, by most accounts, utterly pickled when the wreck happened and had left his ship in charge of the second mate. The onlookers helping get men off the wrecked ship couldn't help but notice that most of the crew members were also drunk, or at least had been drinking. It seems unlikely that if planning to wreck a ship for insurance reasons, the captain would get liquored up before doing so. Nobody who expects to have to swim for his life prepares for the ordeal by getting drunk. And the inebriation of the crew members could explain why nobody climbed up into the rigging to drop the sails before impact. Secondly, there is a standing wind shadow in that particular spot, just inside Cape Falcon. If a sailing ship gets into that pocket, getting her to come around can be impossible. She just won't answer the helm. So it's possible that the ship got into that shadow, became becalmed, and drifted onto the rocks, where, in a cruelly ironic twist, the winds picked back up and pinned her to the reef. This also would explain why nobody made any move to drop the sails. They were hoping to catch a stray breeze and bring the helm around. But perhaps the most compelling explanation for the wreck was the age of both officers. 22. Both the first and second mates were barely adults. 20 years before this wreck, anyone who suggested hiring a 22-year-old boy as a top officer on a ship like the Glen Eslin would have evoked gales of laughter, not to mention forcible ejection from the better waterfront watering holes. But by the 1910s, it was common because it had become very hard to find people willing to work on a sailing ship. The difference in the life of a crew member on a steamer versus a windjammer was striking, and only men who had no alternative would sign up to serve on a sailing ship. Victims of crimping, that is, shanghaiing, always a part of the scene, had become an important part of making up a crew. This meant the crews handling ships in 1913 were often incompetent, unmotivated, or both. They also lacked discipline. After all, as hard as it was to find people to serve on a windjammer, what was the skipper going to do? Fire you? With officers, the situation was similar. Sailing ship officers tended to be very young, ambitious fellows who, given the choice of a low-ranking berth on a steamer or first mate on a windjammer, went for the tougher but higher status spot. They earned their stripes and moved on to the steamer fleet to be replaced by the next class of ambitious young fellows in their turn. There is much to be said for ambitious youths, but the system guaranteed a certain level of inexperience in shipboard high command. That left the captain, usually a lonely old salt, surrounded by derelict and incorrigible crew members and callow youths with whom he had little in common, bitterly pining for the glory days of sail. Such a fellow often heard the call of a cup of rum to make it all better for a while, a call Captain Williams clearly had been answering on the day his ship was wrecked. So insurance fraud isn't the only possibility here. And indeed, after a long legal process of hearings and accusations and counter-accusations, the insurance finally paid out $30,000. Captain Williams' license was suspended for 6 months, which probably ended his career. His first mate was reprimanded, and the second mate, who had been in charge at the time, lost his license for a full year. In happier times, just 11 years before, the Glen Eslin had earned a world speed record for a 1,000-mile voyage under sail, after sprinting from Portland to Port Elizabeth in South Africa in 74 days. She still holds that record. After the shipwreck, the ruined vessel was sold for salvage, sight unseen, for $560. But when the new owner arrived and saw what he bought, he turned around and resold it for $100. Today, much of the Glen Eslin's steel hull can still be seen rusting away among the rocks at the foot of the mountain. It's all that remains of what was probably the fastest sail-powered freighter ever built. Key sources in this story included works by James Gibbs Jr., Basil Lubbock, and Don Marshall. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 500 stories originally created and published in newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulplit Productions, pulp-lit.com, which is a boutique publishing house owned and operated by yours truly, specializing in audiobook and multimedia editions of the work of the classic pre-war pulp writers. This podcast is covered under Creative Commons license type CC by SA 4.0. Basically, that means you can do anything you want with the content. Reprint it, remix it, add to it, songify it, post it on your blog, fire up the old Cessna and skywrite it, whatever you want to do, as long as you A, give me credit for it, and B, whatever you make is also released under a Creative Commons license. But hey, if you need either A or B waived, hit me up, fj@offbeatoregon.com. Don't let my old middle school principal fool you. I actually do play well with others. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode, or maybe you'd like to get together and have a cup of coffee or a pint of Hammerhead and talk history, email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it, and the next one will be a Friday episode, which means it'll be brand new. So until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.